at Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, with Democrats in control of the White House and Congress, we'll talk to a reporter about what lies ahead for immigration policy in the U.S. First, it's the second day of the second impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump. And it's the week in Washington where we take a look at several top stories in national politics. In addition to the impeachment, we'll talk about the status of President Joe Biden's COVID recovery and aid proposal and new criminal investigations into Donald Trump in Georgia. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What responses do you have to yesterday's opening of the Senate impeachment trial and the arguments from House impeachment managers so far today? Have you been watching the managers make that case? Has what you've seen or heard changed your mind at all? What are you hoping that senators do? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Adam Woldner is deputy editor for McClatchy, D.C. He's from Wisconsin, by the way. Adam, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks so much for having me back on. Hope you all are staying nice and warm out there.
Well, it's not easy. We're trying. It's very cold.
Yeah.
It will be for a while. You're keeping track. Yeah. Before we dig into some of the particulars in this impeachment trial, your general thoughts, your reactions so far, Adam, to what you've seen.
Yeah, so we're now in day two here of the Senate's impeachment trial, as you've mentioned. And so far today, we've mostly been getting the Democratic side of things. The House impeachment managers are laying out their case against former President Trump here so far today. I'm really trying to build the timeline here in order to make the argument that President Trump did incite this mob that stormed the Capitol a little over a month ago, and making the case, even dipping back into some of his comments in the lead up to the election all the way through to January 6th, trying to show that timeline through videos, through speeches, through tweets. I'm trying to construct this narrative that Trump was indeed responsible for this attack. So that's mostly what we've seen so far today. Eventually here, we're going to get Trump's lawyers and his defense, their side of things. But, we're going to, this is just day two. This is going to continue through the week and likely into early next week.
Let's give a little listen to something from yesterday. One of the president's lawyers, David Schoen, talking yesterday about more of the procedural side of things, something that Republican senators have pointed to when it comes to the constitutionality of the impeachment proceeding itself. Here's a listen.
It is a clear denial of due process and fair trial rights for private citizen Trump to face an impeachment trial so conducted by the Senate. The impeachment article should be treated as a nullity and dismissed based on the total lack of due process in the House. It should be dismissed because of Speaker Pelosi's intentional abandonment or waiver of jurisdiction, if the House ever acquired jurisdiction. And the article should be dismissed because the trial in the Senate of a private citizen is not permitted.
And Adam, that's something that some Republican senators have focused on a lot. It's been brought to a vote, the idea of whether or not it's constitutional to impeach a not sitting president, but former president. How much have Republicans been leaning on that argument?
Very heavily, right? You don't actually hear them much, trying to defend any of Trump's actions or speeches that the Democrats are referring to. They're just taking the argument of it doesn't even really matter so much the case that Democrats are bringing, because this trial shouldn't even be happening. Their argument being that now that Donald Trump is out of office, a former president, he cannot be tried for impeachment. Certainly a debate that I think, most constitutional scholars do agree that this is still constitutional, particularly since he was actually impeached by the House while he was still president. The actions, these were actions that he took while he was president. And it's just now that the trial is happening that he's out of office. But, you have heard some constitutional scholars on the right sort of make that argument. And that's what Republicans are leaning on. And that's really been the big divide already at this moment, where Republicans and Democrats really don't even agree on really the grounds of this trial at the moment, which is why, we kind of already know a lot about the way this is going to go. We've already had a couple of test votes where the majority of the Republican caucus in the Senate has said that this trial is unconstitutional, which makes it extremely unlikely that there would be the 67 votes necessary to convict Trump. Under that scenario, you'd need all 50 Democrats, which does seem likely, but then another 17 Republicans. And right now there's only been a handful that have even voted to move forward if it is constitutional. So it's hard to imagine that they could reach that 17 number in order to convict.
Democrats, of course, argued yesterday that it was, in fact, constitutional. Some of the attorneys, I think, some of the legal arguments cited in the president's attorney's briefs, some of the scholars they refer to said that their work had been misrepresented. But Democrats also trying to now lay out the impact and, as you said, the timeline. I want to give a listen today to lead impeachment manager, Representative Jamie Raskin of Maryland, Democrat. He concluded his opening remarks telling the story of a black Capitol police officer who cried openly in the rotunda after fighting back the mob who had attacked the Capitol. The officer said he'd be called the N-word many times. Raskin quoted the officer. Here is a listen.
I sat down with one of my buddies, another black guy, and tears just started streaming down my face. And I said, "What the F, man? Is this America?" That's the question before all of you in this trial. Is this America? Can our country and our democracy ever be the same if we don't hold accountable the person responsible for inciting the violent attack against our country, our capital, and our democracy, and all of those who serve us so faithfully and honorably? Is this America?
And that quote, Adam, just one of the Democrats' efforts to highlight, I think, the intensity of January 6th in the Capitol. Can you talk about how they've done that with videos and quotes like that one?
Right. Yeah, they're certainly trying to pull on emotional heartstrings here and try to put, you know, the jurors who are United States Senator, who were in United States senators who were in the Capitol as this riot was happening, kind of bring them back to that moment, which is just, you know, it seems like a lifetime ago in a lot of ways, but it really was just a little over a month ago, and how, you know, uncertain and scary it was at times when people both in and outside the building didn't know exactly how everything was going to unfold. So they're using a lot of, you know, what has been reported in the past few weeks, a lot of video that has come out, both that was shot by the media, but also that was amateur. And they've actually been able to unearth some footage that hadn't been seen prior to today, just to show, you know, really how much worse this could have been. Of course, it did result in a handful of deaths tragically, but it could, you know, trying to show that it could have even been much worse than that, had things spiraled even further out of control. So that's the positioning that the Democrats are trying to make. And, you know, it's as much about trying to put pressure on those Republicans who are in this position of, you know, still wanting to defend Donald Trump, who very much, you know, holds a grip on the base of the Republican Party. But, you know, also on the other hand, don't necessarily want to defend his actions, but also, you know, to try and build some goodwill with the public here, to try and hold, you know, Trump responsible and try and ensure something like this doesn't happen again.
We're talking to Adam Wollner, deputy editor for McClatchy, D.C., looking at the top stories in national politics, looking right now at impeachment. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of what you've seen so far in the impeachment process? Do you want the Senate ultimately to vote to convict the president and or to prevent him, the former president, and or prevent him from running for office again? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll look more at impeachment coming up and some of the other top stories in national politics. You're listening to Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Adam Wollner, deputy editor from McClatchy, D.C. We're looking at the top stories in national politics, including the ongoing impeachment trial, the second impeachment trial of former President Trump. Still time for you to join in with your thoughts on that impeachment. Are you watching or listening to it closely? Let us know what you think about what you've seen, what you're hoping comes out of all this. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Let's bring on a caller now. Vivian is with us in Green Bay. Vivian, hi.
Hello. Impeachment. I have written in favor of it to our 8th District House of Representatives person, and I'll be sending one off to Alberta Darling, the senator. But I'm wondering, after this is over, What are the chances that there might be a civil suit? Because I understand he hasn't done anything criminal. This is high crimes and misdemeanor. But a civil suit by the families of people who were killed or injured on January 6th. Is that a, think that might happen?
Vivian, thanks for the call. Adam, you're not a lawyer, but have you heard talk of civil suits being filed post-impeachment? I, in my reading, I haven't read everything. I haven't seen that talked about much.
I haven't seen that either. Not to say that that couldn't happen at some point down the line. I think everyone is very much in focus, very much focused on the impeachment trial at the moment. And maybe that's, you know, they'll review some other options at a later date. One option I will say that has been floated on Capitol Hill, you know, now that, you know, a lot of senators do assume that Trump will be acquitted, is this the idea of a censure that which would only require a majority vote in both the House and the Senate, that they could censure Donald Trump, and then which would prevent him from holding office again through the 14th Amendment. That's actually something that's been floated by Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia, and who's a Democrat, along with Susan Collins, a Republican from Maine. As of earlier this week, the sense was that didn't really have enough support from either party to go forward with it. But if we do get to the end of this trial and we don't get an acquittal, but there is a sense, you know, from enough senators that they still want to do something to sort of punish Trump or to hold him accountable, that is another avenue that could be explored down the road.
Thanks for that call, Vivian. We'll go to Diana now, calling from Blair. Diana, hi.
Hi. Yes, two quick comments. I heard after it was obvious Trump had lost the election, given an interview, that he had a lot of friends in the military. He was very friendly with a lot of members of the military. And I was listening to the BBC on the night of the insurrection, June 6th, and they caught one of the rioters shouting out after Trump gave them orders to leave that we have to leave. He has given us our orders, so we have to leave. So who do you think is responsible for the insurrection?
Diana, thanks for the call. We're seeing in the cases of many people charged in the insurrection, Adam, they saying they thought they were doing what President Trump wanted. And I think the House impeachment managers here are definitely trying to make the case that the people who came into the Capitol thought they were doing so on behalf of President Trump.
Absolutely. Yeah, that this has been a core of the impeachment managers' argument thus far, and it has been backed up by a lot of, you know, both just, you know, kind of what was plainly obvious that the day of the riot, that many of the people storming the Capitol were wearing Trump gear. But then, as you know, in some of the recordings and the video that have come out since, that they did feel like they were there, you know, on President Trump's behalf. And because of that, you know, this has been another part of the House impeachment manager's argument, is that the President Trump didn't act quickly enough to sort of tell everybody to disperse, that he waited a few hours after the riot had begun before he kind of gave his most explicit orders for everybody to leave the Capitol and go home. So that is certainly a very important part of the Democrats' argument in this trial.
Well, we'll keep watching the impeachment process through the rest of the week. Want to move to some of the other stories going on. One related one I want to touch on briefly in Georgia now, and this would be a state level prosecution. Prosecutors actually in Fulton County, Georgia, investigating former President Trump for potential multiple criminal offenses related to his efforts to get election officials and politicians in the state to overturn election results there. Just announced to, or reported on today. Adam, what do we know about that?
Right. So prosecutors in Fulton County in Georgia have launched a criminal investigation into Trump over his attempts to overturn the election results there. Most notably, he had a phone call in which he pressured the Secretary of State there to, in his words, find enough votes basically to help him reverse the outcome there. So certainly this is something that will be hanging over Trump for a while now. And it's just sort of a reminder that even once we do get out of this impeachment trial, and even if Trump does get acquitted and Congress doesn't do anything further to censure him or punish him or anything like that, he still is going to be vulnerable to a lot of these sort of lawsuits going forward. There already were a couple filed against him in the state of New York for various different topics. Now we have this in Georgia. So, he certainly is going to continue to be in some, legal trouble here going forward, no matter the result of the impeachment trial.
It's our weekly look at the top stories in national politics. Adam Molnar is with us, deputy editor from McClatchy, D.C. Well, let's move on to our current president and what he's working on now. Adam, over at the House, President Biden's $1.9 trillion plan for coronavirus recovery and aid is being worked on in multiple committees. What is the latest there?
That's right. So after last week, when Democrats in both chambers were essentially able to pass the rules that are going to be able to allow them to pass this COVID relief package with a simple majority vote rather than requiring 60 votes in the Senate, which would mean that some Republicans would need to get on board. They are now able to kind of move forward with the actual drafting of this bill. And the Senate is, of course, tied up with the impeachment trial this week and probably early into next, which means that they really can't tackle any other business at the time. So now, in the meantime, the House is doing its committee work in terms of getting this bill ready. And the goal, for Joe Biden and the Democrats is to kind of have this all ready and approved by the middle of March, because March 14th is a key deadline for when some unemployment aid runs out. And that's something that they want to avoid here, to make sure that there isn't that everyone is covered by that. And the COVID relief package would sort of take over after that. So so that work is continuing in the House, and the Senate will almost assuredly pick that right back up after the trial concludes.
And as you mentioned, they're doing it in a way that would be unfilibusterable, if I can make up a word. I'm pretty sure I just made that up. It's this reconciliation process. Congress gets to do it just, a couple times a year if they want. It has to be related to funding. It was how Republicans had passed a tax cut a few years back. Talk about this reconciliation process a little bit.
Right. So without it, it would require 60 votes in the Senate to pass President Biden's COVID relief package. And that would mean, given the current split of the Senate, where it's 50-50, you need 10 Republicans on board. And while Biden and his administration were hopeful in the early goings that they could reach some sort of bipartisan consensus and get some Republicans on board, it became pretty clear early on that they weren't going to reach that. And they wanted to move quickly on this. Like I said, they're hoping to get this all done by mid-March. They didn't want to stretch on too long after that. So they just decided to kind of forego that aspect, pass the budget reconciliation so that they can pass it on a simple majority vote in both chambers, which would mean that they would only need Democratic support here. On the one hand, President Biden has preached the message of bipartisanship and unity. And I think, ideally he would have liked to get some Republican support on this, but his administration has also pointed to the fact that while, a COVID relief package may not fare well with both parties in Congress, it does have broader support among the American public. Poll after poll has shown that a strong majority do support passing this COVID relief package. That includes Democrats, independents, and some Republicans. So that they're kind of using that as a basis to be able to move forward with this in a political sense, and just to ensure that people get the assistance that they need in a timely fashion. So that will certainly be the top priority here in Congress after the trial concludes.
Now, another attempt to use the reconciliation process was the effort to overturn the Affordable Care Act. That ended up falling short because of some defections by key Republican senators. Is there a thought that there might be Democratic senators this time around who might be sticking points to let this go through?
That's right. It's the way that the COVID relief package exists and the way President Biden introduced it is almost certainly not how it will look by the end of this process, because as you mentioned, particularly in the Senate, when it's 50-50, just one defection would doom the bill. And, it's a relatively tight majority in the House as well. So they have to sort of balance the wishes and the demands of the more progressive wings and the moderate wings of the party. So there will be, probably some things that don't quite make it through. There was a $15 minimum wage that was originally a part of this. That's something that some more moderate Democrats have already raised objections to, may not make it through. So while that package currently stands at $1.9 trillion and features a lot of different aspects, it will probably be slightly pared down by the time that we, get to the end of this process, but will still be, a fairly sizable package and one that should be able to get the support of most, if not all Democrats in Congress.
Now, looking ahead to next week, we just learned that President Biden is planning to make his first official visit within the U.S. to Milwaukee, the Pabst Theater, on Tuesday for a live CNN-hosted town hall event. Should we read much significance into the fact that Wisconsin is first on the dance card here?
I think only that, as you all know very well, it's an important battleground state, one that was key to Joe Biden's victory over Donald Trump in November. So, you know, no surprise that that's one of his first stops here on the calendar. You know, I'm sure, you know, he'll try and highlight some of the success they've had in terms of, you know, getting, you know, more COVID vaccines out there. You know, I know Wisconsin now is rising up the list in terms of the number of vaccines that have been distributed thus far. And I'm sure he will also use it as an opportunity to push his COVID relief package and highlight, you know, some individuals or some businesses in Wisconsin that would benefit from that passing. So, you know, I would say, you know, Wisconsin is always going to be, you know, at the center of the political universe sooner rather than later. And Biden decided to do it maybe sooner than we expected.
And Adam, in our last minute or so, impeachment, obviously a big story, COVID relief. Anything else you've got your eye on that's off the radar?
I think it will be interesting to see what Biden decides to tackle next. What is going to be his big legislative push after the COVID relief package? You know, we saw, you know, kind of the first year of a presidency, you really kind of have one chance. You know, you have kind of your honeymoon period, that first year where it's not an election to push something big through. You know, President Trump did it with the tax cuts. Barack Obama did it with the Affordable Care Act. What is that for Biden? He's got a couple of options. He's talked about reforming healthcare further. He's talked about immigration. He's talked about gun control. It'll be interesting to see what he decides to make his signature legislative push once we get onto the other side of the COVID relief package.
Adam, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Adam Woolner is a deputy editor from McClatchy, D.C. We talked to him today in our weekly look at the top stories in national politics, looking at day two of the impeachment trial of former President Trump, as well as the House of Representatives working on parts of President Biden's coronavirus relief package. Coming up after the news, Congress could soon draw up a path to citizenship for some people who are brought to the U.S. illegally as children. We'll look at what could be ahead when it comes to immigration reform. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, vaccinations are rolling out for COVID-19. Can your employer require you to get the shots? An employment law expert tackles legal questions about vaccines and the workplace. That's tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show. Now, some members of Congress are working on a new version of the DREAM Act aimed at providing a legal status for people brought into the country as children without documentation. But as with most immigration action in Congress, there are serious obstacles. Advocates are now closely watching a case in Texas that could end protections for people brought to the U.S. illegally as children that could theoretically compel Congress to take action. A ruling in that Texas case is expected within days or weeks. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you waiting for legal status in the U.S.? How do you want to see lawmakers acting on your behalf? Are you against providing legal status for those living in the country undocumented? How do you think Congress can best tackle DACA recipients and wider immigration issues? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Sabrina Rodriguez is an immigration correspondent for Politico. Sabrina, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you wrote, Sabrina, about this court case in Texas that some people think could spur Congress to take action. Tell us about this case, how we got to it, what it's all about.
Yeah, well, you know, we've been seeing since, you know, 2012, when the DACA program, you know, first came into existence under the Obama administration, there's been several legal challenges over the years, you know, a question of the legality of Obama stepping in to do this when, you know, most issues on immigration and law surrounding immigration is supposed to come from Congress. You know, this is the latest in a long line of cases, but this could be the one to truly end the program. Now, the question is obviously going to be in the details of a ruling on it, where if, you know, this judge, this federal judge in Texas decides, you know, DACA is unconstitutional, we need to end it, how immediate will it be? A lot of the, you know, a lot of immigrant advocates do expect that they would be given some kind of, you know, time frame in, to, you know, to phase out the program. But, you know, with that, and that end could trigger Congress doing something. However, as you mentioned kind of at the top of this, is Congress has had lots of challenges in passing immigration reform in the past. But with, you know, a Democratic president and Democrat majority in the Senate and the House, this might be the best time to make it happen.
In your report, there's some bipartisan action. You've got Democratic Senator Dick Durbin from Illinois and Republican Senator Lindsey Graham from South Carolina working on a new version of the DREAM Act, which would give some kind of legal status to the people in that DACA category, the Dreamers, so-called. What are they working on?
Yeah, so just last week, they introduced, again, for the, it's been 20 years since the DREAM Act has been around, and they reintroduced their version for this year that would legalize about 2 million undocumented immigrants and give them a pathway to citizenship. Bills that are being toyed by different lawmakers on both sides of the aisle that would get at, you know, how to deal with DACA recipients and the broader Dreamer community, as well as other undocumented immigrants. So it's going to be a big question of where do people go? What, who, essentially, what is the bill that's going to have the most support? And at this point, we don't know which it'll be. But DREAM Act has been popular throughout the years.
Want to give a listen to Senator Durbin from Illinois giving an emotional speech about the legislation.
As the child of an immigrant, I never dreamed that I would have this opportunity to lead the committee in the Senate that writes our nation's immigration laws. To all of the dreamers out there, let me tell you this. Passing the DREAM Act is still my highest legislative priority.
So we, here we are, Sabrina. There's some bipartisan support for the DREAM Act. There's a lot of popular support, I think, in polling for it. But it looks like, if I'm reading your reporting correctly, it might, probably won't get a vote all by itself. It's likely to get rolled in with other immigration issues. What are the prospects there?
Yeah, so that's been the complication with, you know, passing in Congress a pathway to citizenship for undocumented immigrants. It never is a standalone bill. It never is just one clean swoop of, okay, we're going to do this now. It always gets mixed up with border security, with how to handle, you know, ICE and immigration enforcement in the United States. And then, you know, progressives will push back on that and say they just want to focus on, you know, the aspect of legalization and the aspect of, you know, being able to allow people to come into the United States and have a pathway to citizenship. So right now, we haven't seen those clear cuts come out yet because we're waiting for the bill to be introduced from the Biden administration. They have their own plan for, you know, a big sweeping immigration reform package that should be introduced in the coming weeks. And that's when we're going to start to really see people stake out their corners on how they want to tackle it this time around.
We're talking to Sabrina Rodriguez, an immigration correspondent for Politico, looking at immigration reform possibilities in the U.S. Congress, an update, a new version of the DREAM Act, maybe in the works, though, as you just heard, complicated executive action from the Biden administration as well. You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What do you want to happen? What would you like to see from Congress on immigration issues? Are there things here that would affect you, either personally or a family member or someone who you work with or who works for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Sabrina, there are other things out there, including one of interest to Wisconsin, a Farm Workforce Modernization Act. What is involved in that?
Yeah, so one big piece of this as well has been, you know, we talk about the dreamers, and there are some dreamers that fall under, you know, as farm workers involved in the agriculture industry. But there is a bill that passed in 2019 in the House side, never got a vote in the Senate. So we do see that there is some widespread support for it already that would have a pathway to citizenship, a pathway for just legal status and permanent residency in the United States for farm workers. There seems to be even more energy for that now, given how much we've seen the importance of the agriculture industry with this pandemic. You know, a lot of the conversation in 2020 and now this year's with the pandemic ongoing has been, you know, the importance of the people that are ensuring that we are fed. And, you know, that only has brought home the point that a lot of Democrats and progressives specifically have about passing this legislation. So this is one of the specific bills that's focused on it. But there's also a question of if in a future COVID relief package, the bill, which, you know, is a big discussion with the Biden administration and Congress right now, could include some kind of legal protections for the farm workers that are, you know, currently in the United States working.
So this is all maybe stuff in Congress. There has been executive action from the Biden administration so far. One thing you've reported on is the issue of asylum seekers coming from Central America, mm-hmm. usually through Mexico to the U.S. border. The Trump administration had made deals with some key countries involved. The Biden administration saying, hold on those. What is what changes are in the works there?
Yeah, so the border is, you know, there's a question mark in Congress and there's to some extent a question mark on the border right now, because the Biden administration is really in a place right now where they're trying to undo a lot of the things that the Trump administration did with regards to asylum seekers, refugees, and just border security, you know, along the U.S. southern border. So at the moment, it's, you know, a process of they're signing executive orders, they're asking for all kinds of, you know, reviews and recommendations to figure out how to go forward. But in the meantime, people are still coming. And, you know, there are still people coming and trying to seek asylum in the United States. Just today, we saw the Biden administration, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki, she said, you know, now is not the time to come. She said that in the press. You know, she said in the press briefing today and said, you know, there's really limited circumstances in which people will be allowed into the country. So at the moment, you know, it's not open. It's not, you know, it's not a position that the Biden administration wants people to think that they can come right now and seek asylum and be able to, because in the meantime, they're really going through this process of trying to change the rules and figure out how to undo and change what, you know, Trump did while in office.
We're talking to Sabrina Rodriguez, immigration correspondent for Politico, looking at how Congress could move forward on immigration policy under Democratic control and a Democratic White House, and executive actions as well from President Biden. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What are you watching when it comes to immigration reform and border enforcement and security? What do you want to see from Congress, from the Biden administration? Do you think it's time, decades into debates over the issue, that Congress come together on some kind of comprehensive immigration reform? Or would you like to see piecemeal efforts? If so, which pieces? And if so, what impact does this have maybe on you personally and your livelihood? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Sabrina Rodriguez, immigration correspondent for Politico. We're talking to her about immigration policy, how it might change under this Congress and this presidential administration. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are you watching for, if anything, from Congress and the White House when it comes to immigration and border security? What questions do you have about what's going on right now? Call 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Sabrina, a big topic through parts of the Trump administration was the what amounted to a family separation policy, charging parents as they entered the border, removing their children from their custody, their efforts to reunify them. Where are we with that right now, and what is the Biden administration looking at?
Yeah, so, I mean, that was one of the kind of centerpieces of the Trump administration when you hear criticism about how he handled immigration. You know, the Biden administration, you know, President Joe Biden on the campaign trail talked very much about how he was going to create a task force that would help find the remaining parents of children that had been separated. And just last week, he announced this task force and, you know, did the formal rollout where the current DHS secretary, who was also confirmed last week, Alejandro Mayorkas, is going to be in charge of this task force and will be doing the work of trying to find the remaining separated families, you know, reunite them. There's about 600 or so kids that still have not been reunited with their parents. So it's going to be a question of working with civil society groups, different nonprofits, doing outreach in these Central American countries where they mostly came from to hopefully find their families. And in the case that they are found and they are reunited, then becomes the question of, will they be brought to the United States and allowed to stay here and be given resources? So the executive order that Biden signed kind of left it open-ended, but you know, the primary focus right now is going to be reuniting those remaining families and then seeing how to, you know, make right what happened under the Trump administration.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Ricardo is with us in Madison. Ricardo, hello.
Hello there. So one of the immigration reforms that I am looking for is, of course, reuniting the kids who are separated by their parents. But, of course, also the DREAM Act. I am a DACA recipient myself, and I feel the sympathy of the children who have been separated. That could be me. That could have been me, or it could be me. But I feel like the DREAM Act and an immigration reform here will basically contribute to the revenue of this country, will make us even stronger, especially right now. We have a shortage of people. Of workers. So I feel like if there's an immigration reform, people are willing to pay money in order to have a authorization card, just like DACA. They pay $500 every 2 years. So imagine if you can have a reform that you can that people are willing to pay for this security to be here, how much money that will bring.
Ricardo, thanks a lot for the call. And some people, Sabrina, have pointed toward the economic impact of immigrants as a reason for changing some of the laws and providing paths to citizenship. What kind of things do we hear?
Yeah, I mean, to Ricardo's point, you know, something that's a misconception when we talk about immigration that I hear over and over again is this idea that undocumented immigrants don't pay taxes and are benefiting from, you know, services in the United States without, you know, paying their fair share. The reality is that, you know, all immigrants in this country, the majority, are paying their taxes, whether undocumented or with visas or with, you know, with a citizenship, with an American citizenship. So, you know, that's part of it where we've seen study after study showing the amount of money that DACA recipients, the amount of money that undocumented immigrants are offering to the U.S. economy. And there is, you know, plenty of studies that show that, you know, it's a positive impact on wages. It's a positive impact on earnings. You know, when we're talking about the Texas case that, you know, we were mentioning earlier, in that one, there's been studies that have shown specifically in the 8 states, the Texas and the 8 other states that are involved in it, that all those states would see a drop in GDP if they did not have those DACA recipients contributing to the economy. So it is really across the board that we've seen positive signs on just the impact of immigrants on the economy.
Thanks for that call, Ricardo. We'll go to John now calling from Eau Claire. John, hello.
Yeah, I apologize. You kind of sniped my question. I wanted to touch base a little bit on the economic versus the humanitarian benefits of immigration, but you kind of touched base on that already. Sorry.
But actually, that takes us to an interesting place, John. I'm glad you brought that up. Sabrina, there is, I think, always talk about, okay, how much is the immigration system intended to bring in workers, especially, you know, maybe workers in areas where we need them, like healthcare, versus how much of the proportion of the population we're bringing in is for humanitarian reasons, people seeking asylum, refugees from around the world. What kind of things are you hearing about that balance?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to call it a problem, but part of what we're used to seeing in the media has been a focus, and I am part of it, we are part of it, but, you know, part of the focus is naturally on what's happening in the border, the asylum seekers, where, you know, the family separation policy that has taken, you know, a lot of focus just because of obviously how terrible it was to witness. But there's millions of immigrants that are here on work visas that are, you know, from unskilled laborers to high skill, whether it's working in Silicon Valley with tech companies, whether it's, you know, farm workers that are coming in either temporarily for seasonal purposes or are here practically year round. So, you know, it's not just asylum seekers. It's not just people that are coming from terrible situations. You know, the Biden administration last week announced that for the next fiscal year, they're going to raise the cap on how many refugees can come in to 125,000. You know, that's just a small chunk of what we see in the country when we're talking about immigrants. And, you know, the vast majority are here working in different jobs and have different focuses. Now, if we're talking about healthcare, for example, that's a chunk of also thousands of people that could be coming in. We've seen, for example, at the beginning of the pandemic, this is very close to home, but seeing, you know, Canadian nurses coming across the border to help with, you know, just handling the pandemic. So we really do see it not just as asylum seekers, not just as people coming, you know, seeking refuge in the United States from terrible conditions in other countries, but some that are really contributing in other ways to the workforce in the country. So it's, you know, I hate to repeat that how complicated it is, but it comes from all different directions when we're talking about immigration.
Sabrina, I've seen some reporting that some business groups are very curious about this work visa issue, maybe a little frustrated that the Biden administration hasn't been more clear about that. In part, I think they just wanting certainty to know what the rules are before they go trying to hire people from other countries. Is that something you're seeing yourself?
The Wall Street Journal had a great. Yeah, it's been a concern already, you know, that the administration hasn't talked too much about it. The focus in his first in office has been very much on the question of undocumented migration, you know, family separation, asylum seekers, the situation at the border. But, you know, business groups and immigrant advocates are saying, okay, but, you know, Trump also did things to change our legal immigration system that need to be fixed, need to be changed. And, you know, there needs to be a process in place that people understand and can follow. So right now it's a question of what Biden is going to do. He hasn't been very clear on it. He signed an executive order as well last week that was saying, you know, starting a review process of barriers to legal migration. You know, one question is very much that the system in the United States is very backlogged. If you apply for a visa, if, you know, you qualify to apply for a visa right now, it can take years to get it just because of how backlogged the system is. So part of what's, you know, what everyone's waiting on is how is Biden going to change that? And how is he going to undo the ban that Trump put in place last year and even expanded that, you know, aim to block foreigners who might come into the United States and take jobs that, you know, other Americans could take? So right now we don't know. You know, Biden has criticized that ban many times and talked about it, but he hasn't given us the path forward on that front.
Sabrina, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Sabrina Rodriguez is an immigration correspondent for Politico. She talked to us about how Congress might or might not work together on the many various elements of immigration reform. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, family caregivers are facing a tough time deep into the pandemic. We'll get some advice from an expert, and you could share your own experiences. Act 10 is 10 years old. We'll look back at the passage of the state law restricting public employee unions, the protests that followed, and their impact a decade later. Plus, we'll get the latest in the ongoing impeachment trial. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Over the last year, a lot of us have gotten used to online video meetings for work or school or get-togethers for family and friends. And if you're doing it a lot, it can start to get routine, maybe even boring. But there's a new way to add some fun to that Zoom or Meet or whatever, a surprise live appearance by a goat. And that's not a slang acronym for greatest of all time. I mean a real no-foolin' goat. As reported in the Washington Post, a farm in Lancashire, England, is offering guest appearances on Zoom by one of their goats. Started as a publicity stunt, the owners of Cronkshaw Fold Farm thought that offering their goats for online meetings would, you know, help boost their produce sales. But then it turned out that people really wanted to bring goats into their meetings. An appearance by one of their goats cost €5, about $6. Usually the host of the meeting or gathering brings in the goat as a surprise. A lot of happy customers say the goats were a big hit. When you reserve your goat, you could choose from among 7 of the farm's dozens of goats, and you can use their bios to help you pick the right one. According to the website, Lulu offers the floppiest ears and the fuzziest belly fluff, a complete disregard for other goats and camera operators' personal space, and extreme jealousy should you dare mention the cuteness of any other goats during your call. While Sebastian will bring you polite and courteous manners, a genuine interest in what you have to say, and soft, velvety ears. Pick your goat. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.